Chapter 3. Frankenstein. The Year Without a Summer. In May 1816, after 2 long years of study, Mary Shelley wanted to try her hand at writing her own stories. But the literary legacy of her parents and other Gothic writers intimidated her. She wanted to follow in their footsteps, but she also wanted to be original. How could she inspire terror and awe in her reader like the writers she admired, while maintaining her integrity and her own literary vision? She was not sure she was capable of achieving this, but she wanted to try. On the trip to Geneva, she kept notes in a journal she shared with Percy, recording the many adventures they encountered. Even though it was spring, the snow was thick and heavy, making the passes almost impossible. A volcanic eruption in Indonesia the preceding April, the world's largest explosion in over 1,500 years, disrupted weather patterns in Europe, Asia, and even North America. 1816 would become known as the Year Without a Summer. In Switzerland, the storms raged, making the journey over the Alps a terrifying and dangerous experience. A truly sublime episode for these young romantics. They even got stuck in a blizzard, thrilling Percy, but worrying Mary Shelley and Claire, who feared they might never get free. Later, Mary Shelley would use her account of the wintry landscape in the original edition of Frankenstein. The scenery perpetually grows more wonderful and sublime, pine forests of impenetrable thickness, and untrodden, nay, inaccessible expanse spread on every side. Never was a scene more awfully desolate. The trees in these regions are incredibly large and stand in scattered clumps over the white wilderness. The vast expanse of snow was checkered only by these gigantic pines and the poles that marked our road. No river or rock-encircled lawn relieved the eye. The sublime scenery, the awful desolation, the incredibly large trees, the wilderness, were thrillingly novelistic, and she knew it. By writing down these details, she was making her first attempts to capture the sublime moment on the page, laying the foundation of Frankenstein, weeks before she actually began the story. At the same time, she was also emulating the style of her mother's letters written during a short residence in Sweden, Norway, and Denmark. A book that her father had cherished, as he thought it showed a gentler side to Wollstonecraft than a vindication of the rights of woman. But letters also revealed the complexities of Wollstonecraft's interior life and her new focus on passions rather than political philosophy. While reveling in the glories of the Scandinavian summer, Wollstonecraft prioritized her emotions, thoughts, and memories. She describes wandering in the countryside, relishing the smell of the pine and the taste of fresh strawberries. Recovering from a broken heart, she finds nature at once healing and inspiring. Her solitary rambles offered an avenue toward self-revelation and the exploration of her inner world. An encounter with a waterfall induced a transcendent experience, resulting in a sublime moment for Wollstonecraft, leading her to contemplate death and her own mortality. My soul was hurried by the falls into a new train of reflections. My thoughts darted from earth to heaven, and I asked myself why I was chained to life and its misery. Still, the tumultuous emotions this sublime object excited were pleasurable, and viewing it, my soul rose with renewed dignity above its cares. Far from England, where she had long faced criticism for her scandalous ideas and lifestyle, she felt liberated to take risks as a writer. She was also released from the domestic responsibilities that at times overwhelmed her as a single mother with a toddler. Mary Shelley could well understand Wollstonecraft's sense of liberation, as she too was enjoying the distance from England. Once they were settled in their rooms at the Hôtel Angleterre on the shores of Lake Geneva, Mary Shelley rededicated herself to her reading schedule, recording in letters and her journal that she was as happy as a new-fledged bird. In the evenings, they sailed across the lake. The water was so clear that she could see all the way to the bottom of the lake and watch the minnows drift by. These details stayed with her, and a few months later, she would use them in her description of Frankenstein's One Afternoon of Happiness on a lake with his new bride, who exclaims, "Look at the innumerable fish that are swimming in the clear waters, where we can distinguish every pebble that lies at the bottom. What a divine day! How happy and serene all nature appears!" But Mary Shelley's pleasure was soon marred by the other English tourists, who refused to speak to her once they learned who she was. When she and Claire entered the public rooms, people turned their backs or gave them hostile glares. When Byron and his 21-year-old personal physician, John Polidori, arrived, the social situation became even more tense. Rumors flew about, and the press, who were always fascinated by Byron's activities, spied on them, labeling them the League of Incest, declaring that Byron was sleeping with both Mary Shelley and Claire, and that Percy probably was too. To escape the gossip, Percy rented a chalet called Maison Chapeau on the opposite side of the lake from the hotel. Byron and Polidori followed, moving to the beautiful Villa Diodat about 50 yards up the hillside. Figure 4. A grand stucco house with 3 stories, pillars, and a capacious front porch. There was plenty of room here for Byron, Polidori, and the Shelley party to dine and enjoy long after-dinner conversations. The Genesis of Frankenstein. By early June, the weather grew increasingly stormy. Weeks went by without a break from the rain. The clouds hung low in the sky, blocking the view of the mountains, the Hotel Angleterre, and the villages across the lake, giving the young people a sense of being cut off from the rest of the world. At first, the group enjoyed the novelty of their isolation, but before long, they grew restless and turned to reading ghost stories and tales of terror taken from a German collection, translated into French, under the title Phantasmagoriana. They also read Coleridge's poem, Christabel, in which a serpent, disguised as a woman, tries to seduce an innocent maiden named Christabel. Percy was so terrified by this poem that he screamed and ran from the room. Later, he said that he had had a vision of a woman who had eyes instead of nipples on her breasts. To Byron, Mary Shelley, and the others, this fit was evidence of Percy's poetical nature, as they regarded such visions as an important aspect of the creative process. 15 years later, Mary Shelley would write a version of these events for her introduction to a new edition of Frankenstein, revised for the Bentley Standard Novel series. She left out Shelley's panicked response to Christabel, but told her readers a story that has since become famous. According to her account, Byron declared that they needed scarier tales than the ones from Phantasmagoriana. Everyone there should write a ghost story, he decided, and a winner would be selected. Truly, this was a gothic challenge, issued in a gloomy gothic setting, hemmed in by the fog, the mountains, and the storms. A perfect contest for these young writers. Byron and Percy set right to work, but soon lost interest and went back to their other projects. Polidori wrote the draft of a story that would become The Vampire, one of the inspirations for Bram Stoker's famous tale, Dracula. But it was Mary Shelley who would win the challenge. The first sentence she wrote, "It was on a dreary night of November that I beheld my man completed," seemed to unleash all that would come next, as though the story were waiting to spill onto the page. She invented a student named Victor Frankenstein, obsessed with mastering the creation of life, who cuts himself off from everyone he loves to devote himself to his ambition, using body parts stolen from graveyards and pieces from dead animals to assemble his creation. Figure 5. Many years later, in the 1831 edition, Mary Shelley maintained that it took her a long time to come up with an idea, and that when an idea did arrive, it came in the form of a kind of waking dream, a nightmare. I saw, with shut eyes but acute mental vision, I saw the pale student of unhallowed arts kneeling beside the thing he had put together. I saw the hideous phantasm of a man stretched out, and then, on the working of some powerful engine, show signs of life, and stir with an uneasy, half-vital motion. These are Mary Shelley's own words, and so there seems no reason to question her story, except that both Percy and Polidori had different versions of what happened in the summer of 1816. In the preface to the first edition, Percy makes no mention of her struggles to start her tale, nor does he mention any dream. All he says is that the group of friends agreed to write such a story, founded on some supernatural occurrence. Polidori's diary supports Percy's account. Fascinated by Mary Shelley, Byron teased him about falling in love with her. He filled his journal with details about Mrs. S. and did not record any delay on her part, casting doubt on her vision, since if she could not come up with an idea, he would have noticed. What seems most likely, then, is that Mary Shelley's story about how she came to write Frankenstein is probably just that, a story, a fiction tacked onto her larger fiction, another layer in a many-layered book. There are many reasons why the older Mary Shelley may have decided to add this preface to the 1831 edition of Frankenstein. In 1818, Frankenstein had been published anonymously, and most people assumed that Percy, or even her father, had written it. She had protested against this, writing to Sir Walter Scott, who had reviewed the book favorably, that she was the actual author. But in the 1831 edition, her name would be on the cover, and she was worried about sales, as she faced financial pressures as a single mother trying to make her living as a writer. Still despised for running away with the married Percy, she knew it was dangerous to confess that she was the author of what one critic referred to as perverse and monstrous fiction. If she could improve her reputation by saying that she had not consciously created the story, then it made sense to invent a tale that would deflect criticism. Talented writer that she was, she imbued her dream with a kind of specific details that made it seem real. When I placed my head on my pillow, I did not sleep, nor could I be said to think. My imagination, unbidden, possessed and guided me, gifting the successive images that arose in my mind with a vividness far beyond the usual bounds of reverie. Here, she presents herself as a passive recipient of images, implying that it is not her fault that this dream has come to her. It is unbidden and possessed her. Instead of asserting her claims as a creative genius, she declares that she had no agency in the story's composition, a declaration that would seem to contradict Wollstonecraft's call for women to claim their own powers. And yet, Mary Shelley was still Wollstonecraft's daughter, as hidden behind these claims was another, prouder assertion, since, to the Romantics, a dream vision was the mark of a real writer. In the autumn of 1816, Coleridge would write a vivid description of the hallucination that led to his famous fragment of a poem, Kubla Khan. Percy's own vision of the woman with eyes instead of nipples had occurred just one night before Mary Shelley began writing her story. With the story of her own dream, Mary Shelley was asserting her qualifications as a true romantic. Sublime visions like this did not come to just anyone, at least not this kind of vivid waking dream. Only real artists could receive such momentous dreams. In other words, while she appeared to be downplaying her own role in creating the story, she was also asserting her identity as a writer. And not a simple run-of-the-mill writer, but a chosen artist. Sudden bursts of inspiration, vibrations from the immortals, these were the sources of art for a true poet. But whether or not Mary Shelley actually had a dream, one thing is certain. Once she began, she worked steadily, without any apparent hesitation. Percy and the others encouraged her, and she hired a nurse so that she could work every day. When they returned to England that autumn, she continued writing the first draft and finished the book 18 months later. Themes of Frankenstein. Drawing on her own experiences as a child whose mother had died after giving birth, who had lost her first baby, whose father had rejected her, and whose society had condemned her for living with a man she loved out of wedlock, she added an extraordinary plot twist, one that would set her story apart from others and make her one of the most famous authors in English literary history. Instead of having her young inventor feel pride in his completed man, she had him reject his creation, abandoning the creature in horror. This idea, that an inventor would be repulsed by his own handiwork, was foreign to the thinking of many romantic poets. In Prometheus Unbound, the poem he started that summer, Percy celebrated creativity, imagination, and technology. According to the Greek myth, Prometheus created human beings, stole fire from Mount Olympus to give to humanity, and was punished by Zeus for eternity. In Percy's version, Prometheus resists Jupiter's tyranny and becomes a symbol of freedom, a noble, self-sacrificing hero. Essentially optimistic, Percy's vision emphasizes that Prometheus' gifts improve the lives of human beings through advances in technology and the arts. To Percy, there was nothing more sacred than the act of creation, particularly artistic creation. Artists were like gods, capable of inventing new worlds and new lives. In this sense, he was not unlike Mary Shelley's Victor Frankenstein, dedicated to the process of creating at all costs, glorifying the act, without thinking of the consequences. But Mary Shelley was ambivalent about the process of creation. She, too, was fascinated by the story of Prometheus, giving Frankenstein the subtitle, The Modern Prometheus. But she saw the tale through a far darker lens. In her version of the myth, Mary Shelley suggested that the obsessive pursuit of creation could cause harm, particularly if pursued at the expense of human relationships. Creation, for the sake of creation, was not enough, and, in fact, could wreak havoc in the world. What were the responsibilities of the creator for the created? How should one care for one's creations? Children did not ask to be born. The same held true for artificial creations and inventions. It was no accident that she was haunted by Adam's words in John Milton's Paradise Lost, the words she used for the epigraph to Frankenstein. Did I request thee, Maker, from my clay, to mold me man? Did I solicit thee from darkness to promote me? Her own father had cast her off, unfairly, she felt. No child deserved such harsh treatment. Every creature needed a parent. Every creation deserved to be nurtured. She had suffered too much to think otherwise. Without Wollstonecraft, her upbringing had been almost unendurable. Godwin had been distant and unreachable. Children needed nurturing parents, she implied. Indeed, they needed mothers, in particular. Victor Frankenstein's attempt to erase the role of women in the creation of human life wrought real damage. Without mothers, without nurturing parents, children could easily grow up to be monsters, making the world a dangerous place, cruel and filled with hate. Mary Shelley's empathy with the child, the artificially created being, as well as the inventor, gave her a dramatically different point of view from Percy, who is mostly interested in the act of creation and the creator himself, always male. To convey the suffering of the artificially created being, she switched her vantage point from Victor Frankenstein to that of his creature, emphasizing the results of Victor's actions. The transition occurs when the creature, who has been searching for his father, has at last tracked Frankenstein down. At this point in the story, the creature has already committed his first murder, killing Victor's young brother and framing Justine, one of the only potentially strong female characters, as the murderer. Despite his violent acts, the creature pleads for Frankenstein's sympathy, explaining that after he awoke and found himself abandoned, his first instincts were innocent, even virtuous. He describes his high-minded attempts to educate himself, reading books, such as Paradise Lost, and declares, "I ought to be thy Adam, but I am rather the fallen angel. All quotations are from the 1818 version. Longing for companionship, he hides himself near an educated and highly refined family and tries to help them by secretly supplying them with firewood and clearing snow from their path. He tells himself they will accept him, that they will overlook my personal deformity, assuring himself that when he has solicited their compassion and friendship, they will welcome him. But his worst fears are realized when the cottagers come face to face with him. They see his ghastly appearance and are terrified, attacking him before they flee. In revenge, the creature sets fire to their cottage, an indirect allusion to the Prometheus story, swearing eternal enmity to all of humanity and blaming his father for bringing him to life. Despite the violence the creature commits, it is difficult for the reader to condemn him, as Mary Shelley has demonstrated how he hoped to be embraced and suggests that the family's reaction is unwarranted and cruel. But the horrified Victor has no empathy for his son. Instead, he rejects him yet again. Outraged and hurt, the creature says, "If I have no ties and no affections, hatred and vice must be my portion." He declares that he will continue his rampage of murderous revenge unless his father makes him a female companion. "I am alone and miserable. Man will not associate with me, but one as deformed and horrible as myself would not deny herself to me. This being you must create." Frankenstein agrees to this proposition and sets to work on a secluded island off the coast of Scotland until he is overcome by fear and disgust, destroying her. In response, the creature goes on a murderous rampage, killing all whom Victor holds dear, including his fiancée, Elizabeth, forcing his creator into loneliness as well. By depicting the creature's sorrow in such vivid detail, Mary Shelley asks the reader to sympathize with him, even though his father cannot. The creature explains, "I do know that for the sympathy of one living being, I would make peace with all. I have love in me, the likes of which you can scarcely imagine, and rage the likes of which you would not believe. If I cannot satisfy the one, I will indulge the other." The implication is clear. If Victor were to love and nurture his creature, the creature would love him in return and love all the world. But without sympathy, he will become a raging child, an outlaw because of the cruel treatment of his creator. Having emphasized that the creature yearned for love and sympathy before he becomes violent, Mary Shelley underlines the point that it is Victor Frankenstein who is at fault. The creature emerges into consciousness with the natural, good intentions of the innocent child, an idea inspired by Jean-Jacques Rousseau. He comes to naught because of the harsh treatment he receives, not because of any inherent character flaw. Without an education, without the nurturing care of a parent, the creature becomes monstrous, a point that Mary Shelley had gleaned from her mother's emphasis on the importance of education. Parents must guide and care for their children, or these neglected children will run wild and harm society. In one of his final speeches, the creature declares, "My heart was fashioned to be susceptible to love and sympathy, and when wrenched by misery to vice and hatred, it did not endure the violence of the change without torture." Mary Shelley's attention to the creature's point of view adds a complicated psychological layer to her tale. Instead of elevating the creative powers of humankind, as Percy had done, she describes the destruction that ensues after Frankenstein flees from his completed man. In her hands, then, Frankenstein is not primarily a story about creation, like Percy's triumphal tale, Prometheus Unbound. Rather, it is the story of what happens after the act of creation. What are the consequences of Victor Frankenstein's actions? What are his responsibilities as an inventor? What happens to the world as a result of his creation? What happens when he attempts to bypass the role of the mother? And most important of all, what happens to his neglected creation, the creature? What happens to a creature starved for love? Robert Walton and M.W.S. That autumn, Mary Shelley added one more layer to the story, the perspective of Robert Walton, an Arctic explorer searching for the North Pole, who encounters Frankenstein and the creature in the wilderness. Like the Ancient Mariner, Victor feels compelled to tell his story to Walton, and Walton recounts the tale in a series of letters to his sister, Margaret Walton Saville, providing the reader with a third version of events. In his account, Walton describes Victor with an admiration that borders on reverence. He is flattered when Victor says that Walton reminds him of himself, not realizing that one of the characteristics they share is selfishness. Like Victor, he pursues his ambition with destructive single-mindedness, evincing no concern for those he might hurt. Victor encourages him not to give up, even as it becomes clear that his endeavor is endangering the lives of his sailors. In his letters, Walton tries to reassure his sister, who has evil forebodings about his voyage, and urges him to turn back. But Walton is so obsessed with proving his own genius that he refuses to stop. He quotes from Coleridge's Rime of the Ancient Mariner, declaring that he will explore the land of mist and snow, and tells his sister he will kill no albatross, therefore do not be alarmed with my safety. By alluding to this tale of catastrophe, Walton unwittingly acknowledges the dangers of his mission. The rebellion of the sailors demonstrates how deluded Walton has become, as does their refusal to continue, even after Victor gives a rousing speech, telling them that if they succeed, they will be hailed as the benefactors of your species, your name adored, as belonging to brave men who encountered death for honor and the benefit of mankind. When at last he is defeated by the elements and the sailors' threat of mutiny, Walton is cast down by his failure, never realizing that his decision to turn back offers a hopeful alternative to the disastrous choices made by Victor. Even when the sailors rejoice, Walton, obsessed with his failed quest for glory, despairs, though he recognizes that if he had died in the Arctic wilderness, he would cause his sister great suffering. Although the reader never gets to hear Margaret's point of view directly, Walton's references to her letters allow her to emerge as the voice of reason in the novel, an offstage voice, but an important one all the same. Her opposition to her brother's ambition is a crucial counterpoint to the obsessive pursuit of glory by the male characters in the novel, reminding the reader of the importance of love and relationships. That she plays a significant role in the story is hinted at when Victor's plea to Walton to kill the creature is stopped abruptly by an editorial intrusion. Walton, in continuation, cuts short Victor's monologue and reintroduces Walton's voice, who addresses his sister directly, writing, "You have read this strange and terrific story, Margaret, and do you not feel your blood congealed with horror?" Margaret never responds to this query, but Walton's question puts her squarely in the place of the novel's reader, and though there is no attribution to the editorial phrase, she would seem to be the likeliest candidate. As the recipient of Walton's letters, Margaret is the only character who could organize them and control the flow of the narrative, elevating her from an offstage voice to the mastermind behind the organization of the story. As the literary scholar Angela Wright points out, Margaret's point of view lies at the structural and thematic core of the tale. For the reader, it is easy to miss her importance, as we never hear her voice directly, but her vantage point is crucial to the tale, as at no point does she endorse her brother's quest or express any admiration for his heroics. Instead, her criticism remains under the surface of the tale, unspoken, but powerfully present in her brother's invocations. Margaret's significance, and the closeness Mary Shelley felt to her, is underscored by the fact that she gave Margaret the initials she would have if she were married to Shelley and if Godwin was erased from her name. M.W.S. Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley. Though Margaret's point of view is filtered through her brother's letters, her critique of her brother disrupts his attempts to present himself or Victor as a hero. By embedding Margaret in the story, Mary Shelley prevents the male characters from achieving the apotheosis they seek. Her critical viewpoint serves as an invaluable counterpoint to the self-serving accounts of the men. By providing the reader with Margaret's point of view, as well as three different versions of the same set of events, Mary Shelley wrote a complicated story that is far more than a simple parable against the dangers of invention, a reading of the text that persists today. Instead, the central themes of the story, derived as they are from Wollstonecraft, include the importance of education and human connection, as well as the importance of mothers and mothering. But there are other important ideas as well. Mary Shelley points to the dangers of the male pursuit of glory when achieved at the expense of others, particularly women. She also includes romantic ideas about the imagination, reading, writing, and the sublime. In the preface to the second version, she suggests that the novel is also about the origins of life, recounting conversations between Percy and Byron, where the two men discussed experiments that used electricity to animate inanimate objects and wondered if a corpse could be reanimated by these extraordinary measures, an idea with obvious resonances for Mary Shelley, haunted as she had been by the death of her mother and her first child. In her version of events, she does not contribute to the conversation between the two men. Instead, she presents herself as a listener, like Margaret, a woman who hears and distills the conversations of men, but does not speak herself, except off stage, or, in this case, later, and on paper. Accordingly, although it is clear that the creation of life is an essential component of the story, Mary Shelley does not allow the book to be about a single theme. By including the different points of view, she shifts the focus of the book to the complexities of the human heart and human relationships. Ultimately, she raises many questions. What does it mean to be a human being? Who in the story is most human? The creature? Frankenstein? Walton? Margaret? What happens when Frankenstein attempts to erase the role of the mother? The creature's poignant story and his yearning for human connection allows Mary Shelley to suggest that if Frankenstein had relented and had sympathy for the creature, he could have become a positive member of society, despite his fearsome appearance. Sympathy, then, and love, would seem to be one of the most important components of a human being. Components that Frankenstein and Walton lack, but which the creature has, at least before he is corrupted by society, and which Margaret seems to possess as well. Frankenstein and Wollstonecraft. Mary Shelley dedicated the novel to her father, writing that the book was respectfully inscribed to William Godwin. The restraint of this dedication reflected the fact that she and her father were still not speaking. Indeed, despite this dedication, Frankenstein can be read as an expression of longing for her own mother, as well as an impassioned evocation of the importance of mothers in general. By articulating the pain of the motherless creature and describing the damage done by Frankenstein's abandonment of his responsibilities, she was able to demonstrate the tragedy that ensues when parents do not love and guide their children, a theme that she would continue to develop in subsequent works, emphasizing the importance of a healthy, nurturing relationship between parents and children. Her concern about the abandonment of children also stemmed from a belief that she shared with other romantics, that children were innocents who needed to be protected. According to this philosophy, children were closer to nature than adults, and should therefore serve as guides to society. It was the world that was corrupt, not children. The next step seemed inevitable. If all human beings came into the world as innocent creatures, then violent, unstable adults were the result of neglect, bad education, and a diseased society. Despite these Wollstonecraftian themes, at first reading, Frankenstein seems to owe nothing to the principles of a vindication of the rights of woman, as there are no strong female characters, no pronouncements advocating for women's rights, and no statements about the importance of women's education or independence. By the end of the novel, all of the female characters are dead, except for Safie, one of the cottage inhabitants whom the creature attempts to befriend, and Margaret Walton Saville, who, despite her importance, remains resolutely offstage. Ultimately, the world Mary Shelley paints is one in which women are unable to exert any power, and raw male ambition lays waste to society and to intimate relationships. And yet, by demonstrating the violence that occurs when women are not allowed to play an active part in shaping the world, Mary Shelley makes a strong case for the significance of women's roles. If women are ignored, destroyed, or dismissed, she implies, then unchecked male passion will destroy civilization. Relationships will be torn apart. Without strong women, the world will be devoid of meaning, love, and balance, destroyed by men who are ruled by their passion for fame, invention, and achievement. The silent critical voice of Margaret comes to bear, enacting judgment against the excesses of Walton, Frankenstein, and the creature. Importantly, it is this voice that will emerge more clearly in Mary Shelley's later work. Tragedy. While Mary Shelley was writing Frankenstein, two events occurred that served to underscore the dystopian themes of the book. Her half-sister Fanny and Harriet Shelley, Percy's first wife, both killed themselves, highlighting the grim truth that Mary Shelley already knew. Unmarried mothers and illegitimate children were hated by society and driven to despair, just like Frankenstein's creature. Her own mother had become an outcast when she gave birth to Fanny out of wedlock and had tried to commit suicide twice. Fortunately, she had been rescued, but her plight as an unmarried mother isolated her, causing her enormous psychological pain. Fanny, too, had been rendered an outcast by society's strictures. To Mary Shelley, the suffering of her mother and half-sister was unpardonable. Wollstonecraft was innocent, as all she had done was fall in love, which was certainly not a criminal act, and Fanny was just a child, born through no fault of her own. Certainly, she had not asked to be brought to life, any more than Frankenstein's creature had. As for Harriet, her death was an even more complicated burden to bear. For the rest of her life, Mary Shelley blamed herself for participating in Harriet's tragedy by running away with Shelley. Now Harriet had joined the pantheon of women who had been rendered monstrous by society, cast away by the world. Even worse, Mary Shelley benefited from Harriet's death. With Harriet gone, she and Percy were now free to wed. They married in December, 1816. For Mary Shelley, who marked the wrong date down on her calendar, her wedding only served to underscore the injustices of English marital law. It had taken Harriet's death to free Percy, as divorce, for any reason, was almost impossible. In response to these suicides, Mary Shelley experienced a complicated mix of emotions, including regret, sorrow, rage, and guilt, all of which she poured into her novel. She felt a kinship with Fanny and her mother, and now, Harriet. She had been punished by her father, and by society for loving Percy. She worried that Claire, who was pregnant with Byron's child, would soon join this club of outcast women, and that her child would join the ranks of rejected children. Although she could not retaliate against society's cruelty by going on a murderous rampage, she could imagine such a rampage and describe it in vivid, visceral detail. The creature would take revenge on her behalf. But it was also true that she saw herself as complicit in the deaths of all three women. Her birth had resulted in her mother's death. The expectation of her arrival had prompted Godwin and Wollstonecraft's marriage, exposing Fanny's illegitimacy, and Harriet had killed herself because she, Mary Shelley, had run away with Harriet's husband. Mary Shelley spent the spring of 1817 readying the manuscript of Frankenstein for publication, finishing before she gave birth to her third child in September. The significance of the book's gestation period was not lost on her. As the scholar Anne Meller points out, she referred to the book as her offspring, linking the story to her own birth. The tale begins on December 11, 17, and ends in September 17. Mary Wollstonecraft, conceived in early December 1796, gave birth to Mary on 30 August 1797 and died on 10 September 1797. These connections to her own birth suggest Mary Shelley's closeness to her story. Like Frankenstein, she was driven by the ambition to create, in her writing and as a mother. Like the creature, she felt abandoned by her creator, as her birth had been followed by the death of her mother, resulting in a fatal quandary. Wollstonecraft could only have survived if she had not been conceived. And if she had not been conceived, she could never have brought Frankenstein to life. By framing the novel with Walton's letters to M.W.S., another self-reflection, it is as though she wrote the tale for herself, becoming both author and audience, author and editor, creator and created, mother and daughter, inventor and destroyer, Frankenstein and his creature, and of course, Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley, author, and M.W.S., character and editor, the female voices of reason who control the story, but are sidelined from the action. In her subsequent work, Mary Shelley would allow this silent voice to speak. Where the men in Frankenstein dominate the narrative, retelling horrors with no restraint, it is the woman's point of view that she would focus on in her later work. Increasingly, she would shine a light on the strength of reasonable women, allowing them to occupy more important roles until, at the end of her career, it would be the female characters who would triumph over the weakness of the men, leading the way to a new world where horror was restrained by good judgment, where reason reigned over violence. For Mary Shelley, rewriting the balance of the world was as important a mission as writing A Vindication of the Rights of Woman had been for her mother. Deeply moved by the deaths of Fanny and Harriet, she knew that if she wanted to make the world a less dangerous place for women, particularly women who lived outside the pale, she needed to give them the spotlight and allow their suffering and their triumphs to occupy center stage. Only then would audiences learn to have sympathy for them and, even more importantly, come to respect and maybe even embrace their points of view.